Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. Welcome to our 9th anniversary show. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Really appreciate everybody joining us live here today. And for the last 9 years, we were talking a little bit before the show was off and running, and it's kind of interesting that we've been here for 9 years. And if you're with us live, we'd like to invite you, as usual, to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. And if you feel so inclined, you'll find the chat room there. If there are a couple of questions or comments that you wanted us to talk about during today's show, because we don't have a guest, we're kind of doing a free-form spoken word today. You can bring it in there. Or if you look at the top of the show page, it has the number for the switchboard. If you wanted to call in and say we owe you money or maybe ask a question, you're more than welcome to give us a call. And if you got to leave and you want to catch up on what we prattled on about, you can always come back to Blog Talk Radio, get the full archive, or take a shortcut and go over to iTunes or Stitcher or somewhere else and subscribe to the free podcast. Eagle One, happy anniversary.
Yeah, you too, Sal. It's been a remarkably fast 9 years.
9 years. I kept looking, is it 8 years? No, it's 9 years. And like I kind of kick things off, it's kind of humbling that not only people, a lot of folks have been with us from the beginning, but I'll wax your apple a little bit. I've really appreciated the opportunity the last 9 years to talk with you and our guest and explore some of the concepts that we find interesting in the maritime focus and the national security side of the house. Hopefully we've added more light than heat. So I guess just for my own selfish reasons, thank you, illustrious co-host, for the last 9 years up, and we're not quitting, everybody. We're going to keep rolling if the good Lord will let us not assume room temperature.
Yeah, well, same back at you. I mean, it's been interesting getting the great guests we've had and the ability to have what I think you and I have described before as a good cocktail party conversation. You know, just most of the guests just been interesting people to talk to, and that's kind of the way we've approached talking to them.
And that's part of it is maybe our inherent laziness as a couple of retired guys, but we do try to keep it in that conversational point of view. There's not a bunch of post-production or pre-production, because I think, as we've both experienced in our lives, some of the best conversations and insights you can have is when people are relaxed and you're just, as we often tell our guests before we go live, hey, we're just, you know, three folks sitting around a table having a beer, maybe having a conversation. And when I was looking back, I think we'd be remiss if we also didn't thank some folks that have really been with us from day one and have been regular guests over the course of the years, or have helped us find other guests. Of course, we have to kick off Raymond Pritchard. When we first started, there were three of us. And a lot of people will know Raymond from many moons ago. Information dissemination, went around on Galarin for low back 2 decades, for those that wandered around the old bulletin boards. But he was with us as a co-host for most of our first year, until life had other demands of him. Maybe he's come on a few times to talk with us as well. But there's also Claude Barabe, been just a great source of encouragement for us and he's been on a regular basis. Jerry Hendricks, Brian McGrath, our go-to Russian guy, Dmitry Gorenberg, James Holmes and Toshi Yoshihara, that we've had on both as a team and individually through the years. Who'd I miss?
Well, I think Barney Rubble. James Hornfisher, good, great guest. Claude Barrabee, as you said. Let's see. Bill Roggio. John Kuhn, who has been with us frequently. And, you know, we've had so many good folks on several times that, you know, we also need to think of the – I'm like B.J. Armstrong. B.J., his what would 21st century or 20 Mahan, and then the people that have also written the 20 in that series of books that we've had on, you know, that kind of fed a lot of great guests and a lot of great conversations that were derived from that. And we've I'm looking back at the list of people we've had on. As I told you before the show, the statistician in me wants to go I should have had a pie chart of how many episodes these guys appeared on and all this stuff, you know. But it's just been it's been fascinating as a person getting ready for the shows, reading the books that a lot of the guests have written or the articles, and just been a great way for, certainly for me, I hope for our guests, to stay in touch with what's going on in the world and some people who really think seriously about what we should be doing and why we should be doing it.
Yeah, and we tinkered a little bit, at least on the side of, you know, our format, and it after the first year pretty much hit a rhythm, and hopefully our guests enjoy what we enjoy about our format, which is it's a long format. We don't have hard breaks, we don't have soft breaks, we're not sponsored. We're like to give our guests, as all of our guests have been told before the show starts, we like to give them an open forum that to express their ideas, to get their concepts across, where oftentimes if they're in other venues, they got a 6-minute or a 12-minute block or maybe 30 minutes if they're lucky. And they're given a bunch of popped questions, pop, 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 pop. We like to give everybody a lot of running room. And I was looking, and I remember when we first got started, it was just kind of neat when you would look at the stats and like, hey, there is 100 people that had nothing better to do but to listen to us prattle on. And I know some of our listeners are long-term guests. Might be interested to see some of the numbers. I was just looking back at 2018. And most of our shows, even some of our best of pre-recorded shows, which are usually at the lower end of the spectrum, but most of our shows have between 4,000 and 9,000 listens. That's no small audience. And when you look at our top three shows, that tells you where it got the most replay. It got circulated around. The link was emailed, put on social media, things like that. But our number one show of 2018 was when we had Norman Friedman on about building a global Navy. 12,580 listens. Our number two show was actually a repeat of an interview we did with Rear Admiral Thomas Moore about the carrier as a capital ship. And the number three show was Dan Green on Irregular Warfare with 11,453 listens. So we've got Building a Big Navy, we've got Carriers, we've got Irregular Warfare in the Long War discussions. And when you jibe that with the number one show we had in 2017, was it when we had Jerry Hendricks on talking about the 350 ship Navy, that had 18,558 listens. You can get an idea on, at least in our corner of the chat fest, where people's interests are. It's building that big Navy and looking in the future, but also looking at the last two decades of the irregular wars that we've been fighting.
Yeah, I think you know, the people who understand the importance of the Navy or want to know why it's important, I can see why those shows would have been the headliners. I think some of the other stuff, which I think we do that a lot of people wouldn't do, getting into the logistics, getting into the acquisition process, and some of that background information that, you know, it's not sexy as we say, but it is important. And I think that I would like to know that those were also highly listened to shows, but I can understand people who really go for the sexy, you know, let's talk about big ships and aircraft carriers. But there's other stuff out there.
Well, as we have a nice niche interested market, but you're spot on. We don't really aim to, you know, what's the topic that's going to get the most jive or excitement. It's what we and the people that we talk with find interest are, and I know we've done this in a few places, we've intentionally reached out to those areas that are just extremely important that not enough people talk about for a variety of reasons. One of them, I'll tease them. Insecure as all EDOs are, but we had Mark Vandroff on a few times to talk about what is the really hard stuff that goes on in the background. That's program management. That's taking a ship that was designed to last 30 years, and you get the memo that says make it last to 40. It's hard work, not just of people in uniform, but civilians, and you need a lot of support from folks on the Hill. And we've had 4-star admirals on to smart college students that wrote something that we found interesting, which hopefully by getting that kind of broad spectrum, we've given our regular listeners an opportunity to hear a few voices that they might not otherwise hear, or some of the guests we've had on, you might read a 2-line quote in a news article in Defense News on, but lo and behold, we've got them on for a full hour for them to flesh out their ideas. So you get more than just that little sound bite.
Yeah, and I think some other things, we had, I think it was then Vice Admiral Moran on a couple of times talk about personnel issues. And, I don't know that many people are talking to folks like that. Again, it's the background stuff, and maybe the reporters for the Navy Times or Defense News or something are chatting with those guys. But to have him come on for a full hour a couple of times, talk about the issues, I'm impressed with that. And he was a good guest.
And just in 9 years, obviously, we were not the first, but I can put us in the early adopters. I think that, one thing that's been neat to watch is in the podcasting world, in the national security arena, it hasn't gotten crowded, but there's some real quality podcasts out there that have joined us in the talk space in the last few years. You've got the folks over at USNI has a little podcast that they do over there. Of course, the kiddies over at SINSEC have a podcast. War on the Rocks has a podcast. There's a few other ones out there that really do quality production and post-production work. We don't. But I think that's been just a great addition to something obviously we have a lot of buy-in to, and I think is important in a free society, is you have people on here talking about these issues that expand the conversation. That whole thing that if you only got two people in a room and they're all saying the same thing, then they're wrong. You have to have a good conversation. When you look at some of the quality of the folks out there, and the guests that they have in the podcast, maybe it'll be a nightmare for historians down the road, but there's a lot of primary source information floating around in there for those that have long commutes, don't have time to read periodicals at all. You could quickly build a half dozen or so podcast of national security that I think can really keep anybody interested in the topic well apprised of what's going on, and perhaps even more important, maybe have a couple of ideas they haven't thought of before that can percolate around in their noggin as they go about their responsibilities.
Yeah, I think having people on that you may not necessarily agree with, and not be disagreeable, but just ask them questions to let them explain why they have the opinions they have is important, particularly people that don't get the platform very often. So if you have a Kirk Lippold on or a Jung, who's got some interesting opinions that he got to explain, I think, pretty thoroughly on this show, and I think those are important, and they make for a more interesting format than if you just have people on who give you the dittos all the time and really don't challenge either your thinking or other people's thinking about what the really important issues are that are facing this country and the national security aspects of it, and especially in our case, the Navy.
Yeah, that's the key. And it's funny. I think one thing we've both seen through the years, because as our regulars know, even before we started doing Midrats, you and I have been bouncing around the blogosphere since 2004 for both of us. Or did you get a start in 2003? Yeah.
I think I put up some nonsense before that, but really got it kicked off for me in 2004.
Yeah, so that's the same year that I started. And I still put out nonsense, by the way, but that's okay. You get what you pay for kind of thing. And it's a good venue. Even when we don't have guests, we do our free-for-alls and kind of cover the news of the day, so to speak. And being that this is an anniversary show and it coincides with the start of a new year, I thought, let's talk about 2018. And thinking about 2018, obviously anybody could look through our guest list and the things that we talked about. And there's one thing that we haven't talked about. When I was looking back at 2018, it's one thing that I find very interesting that it hasn't quite gelled yet, but it's getting there. There's always that trope that you hear back in the, of course, I don't think it was ever there, but people like to talk about the bipartisan consensus on national security. Maybe there was one, I don't know. But one thing that has happened in the last year that I think is really broken above the background noise, though it's been there for a while, it's not a bipartisan consensus, but almost a bipartisan disunity that the recent announcements of a desire to withdraw the forces that we've put into Syria has kind of brought into a stronger relief, in that you have, not just in Syria, Afghanistan, other places that we're putting forces, you have, for lack of a better phrase, the war party, the one that believes in intervention, whether it's the make the world safer democracy crowd, spot welded to the responsibility to protect R2P crowd. You have people on both the left and the right that are very approachable to sending forces all over the place and increasing where we are and never leaving where we've, once we put our flag in the ground. And then over on the other side, you have people who want to decouple. They want to get out of Syria. They want to get out of Afghanistan. They want to get out of almost everywhere but Kansas. And you have people on the political right and the political left that are in that camp as well, as opposed to what a lot of people are usual. You have the Republican right-wing foreign policy establishment and the Democrat left-wing national security apparatus, and here's their top five and their top five. It's kind of mixed up in a strange way, and that's one thing that came into relief in 2018 that I'm still trying to get my head around, and I'm hoping that it will set a little firmer as we go into 2019, because I think by the time we get to the third quarter of 2019, the presidential election is just going to throw squid ink in the front of everything.
Yeah. You know, politics being what it is, and the way I was listening to Charles Krauthammer's book, one they wrote right before he died, the Things That Matter. And he in that one of his articles, he talks about how the political parties, to get elected now, you have to accuse your opponent of all kinds of heinous things, which means that the American voter is faced with an interesting choice of voting for people that somebody else considers completely heinous. And, you know, Krauthammer's point is well taken, that at one point, and it's happened very infrequently in our history, people used to be nice to their opposing candidate for public office. And, you know, you had real debates, and there wasn't quite the level of mudslinging that we've seen both in early elections in this country and recent elections. But it is a problem that now everything has become, and you knew this was going to happen when I was a young person, when everybody, you know, politics is everything. You cannot escape everything being political anymore. And so any comment made by a civilian, senior civilian person, a senator, congressman, that is either pro or seems anti-military, is met now with comments from people who are even in the military or recently retired. And, you know, I'm not sure where the health in that is. And it's not that I want to violate, you know, want to take anybody's First Amendment rights away, but there's got to be, we've got to learn to balance the political aspects of this better than we do. Because right now, and I think what you're seeing on the war party and the non-war party is that it is broken down into these ugly subgroups, some of which make no sense at all, and some of which, you know, it's just, they're just, sometimes you get the feeling that they're like a two-year-old digging their heels in just because they can. And which is a long way of saying, yeah, you're right.
Well, it's that whole thing that, I don't know, it's not new, it's not the next 2 years, it's not in the last 5 years, it's not in the last 15 years. I remember people were complaining about it back when I became self-aware of such things back in 1990, 91, in the run-up to the Gulf War. You know, that whole cliche that, you know, politics ends at the water's edge. Not really. But it's, I think you may have hit on something, that as our domestic politics goes into a very nasty phase, talking about domestic politics, domestic politicians, parties, you know, does that attitude and way of doing business, how much is that going to bleed over into the national security arena, where you really want the calm people in the room making decisions and providing advice, and not that quite of a vitriolic vein, especially when, and I know people get touchy when I say this, but yeah, we're in a year 17 of a long war, but it's not a war, a low-key operation. It hasn't stressed our Navy, it hasn't stressed our nation like other real wars have. And there are some legal types that will argue that that authorization for use of military force is, has nothing to do with a lot of what we're doing right now. I do worry a little bit about that, that type of, in a global environment where some guy in LA can do a 3-minute YouTube video interviewing somebody and it's immediately watched by somebody in the Kremlin or in Beijing who's building up a daily brief situation and skews his information. Things are just a lot more easily influenced on a global basis for what might be an internecine domestic political. I don't know if it's it always been that. I was still in diapers for the height of. I think I may have been out of diapers by the time of the Tet Offensive. But you have a longer view of things than I do, and you remember Vietnam. Did you have that type of domestic gnashing of teeth and rending of clothes boiling over into the global national security arena the same way we do now, or are we singing a slightly different tune, do you think?
It was, you know, my generation, the boomers, during the Vietnam War, it got really ugly, and it got, you know, it did have an impact on national security issues, because the, among other things, the Vietnamese knew that if they could hold out long enough, that, you know, they and foment that sort of rioting, blowing up of army or ROTC buildings, attempts to levitate the Pentagon, that if they could help cause that trouble, that then it was going to come to a head by U.S. Doing what it eventually did, which is abandoning the South Vietnamese. And whether we should have been there in the first place is a completely different issue. But you know, once you've made a commitment, and this is where this goes into deep trouble for us. Every country since Vietnam and some of these non-state actors like Al-Qaeda have said the same thing. The United States has no staying power. They will not accept casualties. In fact, I think some Chinese admiral said this the other day about killing our carriers. You know, that we do not want casualties, because every casualty gets reported, you know, some mother's child. You know, the way we do our reporting of casualties is skewed anyway. That we can't handle casualties. We have no staying power. Anything that lasts more than 15 minutes, we seem to think is too long. And sadly, the first Gulf War, which took a remarkably short period of time once the war actually started, spoiled us. You know, it was clean. We didn't lose that many people in combat. And so now you go through a very long war in Afghanistan, a very long war in Iraq, and whether those have been handled right or wrong, you know, I'm sure they'll be debating 100 years from now. But it, you know, the idea behind what the Taliban does, what ISIS does, what Al-Qaeda continues to do, is that if they wait long enough, we're going to go home. They're already there. They're at their homes, and they'll just wait for us to leave and then do what they're going to do. And, you know, their precedent for that is what we did in Vietnam.
Yeah, the first thing that came to mind when that article that got a lot of play about that Chinese admiral wanting to sink a carrier or two, which makes sense. If I was a Chinese admiral, that's what I would be focusing on. But that's called doing your job. But yeah, that's one thing that is a known unknown, because let's look at Iraq since 2003 and Afghanistan since 2001. How many Americans have been killed in Iraq? So far, 4,563 Americans have been killed in Afghanistan, 2,417. Doing my little math at the back of the hand, that's 6,980 Americans that have been killed since 2001, just in those two conflicts. Now, when you seek a carrier and assume the air wing is on there, depending upon who's who in the zoo and what you're doing where, that's 5,000 to 5,500 people. And depending upon how the carrier is hit and killed, how many dead Americans is that? Conceivably, if it is a sustained attack at the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, you can lose as many people in one day that we've lost in Iraq since 2003. It doesn't take much weaponeering to come up with a scenario where out of 5,500 people, 4,500 of them die. When you look at what happened to the Hood, you look at what happened to the Bismarck. Capital ships, when they go, unless they just take one or two torpedoes, they go dramatically. And nobody's ever sunk a nuclear-powered warship before either, so who knows what extra goody that'll bring to the play. What would be the American reaction to that? I think back on Twitter, Jerry Hendricks and I went back and forth a little bit about what not just Americans, but especially overseas, a lot of people lose the perspective of, is there's something in the American character. People who are big on genetics have written some interesting things about the people who settled this country and what those personalities are, and there's some genetic component to them, plus a little bit of our history, where very, very shallow beneath the skin is a Jacksonian berserker waiting to come out. I have no idea what the reaction would be if we woke up tomorrow and there are 4,500 plus dead Americans at sea. But I don't think it would be to call the UN Security Council together to form an investigative committee. Navies, when they're vulnerable and when they fail, from a casualty point of view, it's the numbers get shockingly large. I don't know if even in 2019, if the American reaction would be to roll into a ball. It's not our nature.
Yeah, I don't think so. And it's not just the carriers. I think when we had, so we put more and more assets on fewer and fewer but larger ships, and we've discussed this, I think, with Wayne Hughes, actually, that the loss of each one of those ships now becomes more devastating than if you have, a larger number of ships, each with fewer assets on it. So, and that's the deal with the carriers. I mean, if we have 13 carriers, 12 carriers, as opposed to World War II, when we had, Lord knows, 50, 60, it was just a huge number. And the same thing with the, as Scott Brim points out in the chat room, you got an amphib with a couple of thousand Marines on it, or an amphibious task group, or all these ships, the large logistics ships designed to support people ashore. You know, you lose one of those, you've lost a huge amount of material and manpower. And We need to think really clearly, and I hope there are people doing this, about exactly, this is a good thing for 2019 probably, what does the future look like as we get these weapons that are different than they used to be, and what about the Chinese on the moon? Is there a risk of war from space? I think we've discussed that sometime in the past, and we need to really get those futurists pondering some of these great issues that can impact the Navy and the security of our country.
Yeah, I like the fact you brought up the amphibious issue again. And, like I said, we have talked about through the years, but the numbers are a little shocking. And I want to violate my own rule here, but we're live and we're running fast. If you can go over to Wikipedia, which actually their warship sections are pretty good. You look at a Wasp class LHD. It has a complement of 1,208 and can carry 1,687 Marines. That's almost 3,000 people on an LHD. You lose that. First of all, wherever you're going, you're not going there. That's the one thing that whichever is the first Navy to go into a real, no kidding, naval battle, which will happen again, I think that's one thing that's going to come in clear relief, is not so much we don't have enough ships, but the ships that we have are too important. They're too big. And there are other things that you find out that people warned about in times of peace that come into broad relief when you go to war. One of my favorite examples, and you look at the, I'm sure I'm going to get beaten up if I get it wrong, I think it's the broadsword class frigates of the Royal Navy. They did them in three batches. Batch one and two had no gun. The third batch did. They put a 4.5-inch on the front because sitting there in Goose Green, if you didn't have a main gun, you're in trouble. So you learn those things in war, and there just hasn't been a big naval war or even a medium-sized naval war in so long. But that's one of those things that keeps tapping me in the shoulder, especially when we're looking headed to Westpac. That's a big ocean. It takes a long time to get there, and you can't hide. Maybe a big ocean, but today you just can't hide. Still there, Eagle One?
Yeah, once you get past those island chains, too, past Guam, you know, you've got choke points. You've got choke points out to Yin Yang, and they're, you know, it's a challenge for the Chinese coming out. It's a challenge for us going in. If that were an area where we're contemplating some kind of activity. And, you know, and this the stress on the importance of things like choke points, you know, that the stuff that the broad ocean, blue ocean, you know, really deep water stuff is where a lot of people think that the Navy is doing its stuff. But those of us who've been around a while know that everything happens fairly close to shore. Everything important happens fairly close to shore. I don't recall in the United States Navy, with the possible exception, I won't even say that. I was going to say Midway, but Midway took place because there were islands and it was important water. But, you know, things happen close to land. And that is a point that Wayne Hughes keeps making in his books. And we don't listen often enough. And we keep building these giant ships that do, you know, that's got a huge amount of capability, but we can't afford to build enough of them so that we have some fallback capacity. And, you know, that's where you get bitten. Down the road, if you could build one giant ship that does everything, but boy, lose that ship, and you can't do nothing.
And you can see where the big ships make sense from an economy of scale point of view, but it's finding that balance between capability, costs. But then performance, I think that push that started well over a year ago, and I'll give Brian McGrath credit because he started banging the gong with a few other people about a long-needed discussion about the efficiency versus effectiveness. I think that, though it's hard to tell because they don't talk to people as much as they used to, I think Navy leadership has that on board. I've heard some very encouraging comments and discussions taking place, but it takes a while to really turn and to change things. I think there's an appreciation of that. The buzzword of the week, distributed lethality, I think was a reflection of that. The recent discussions about taking advantage of some of the built-in white space in the LPD 17 class, where we could put, and I think originally was designed to have some VLS cells in there to move some of that capability around, mitigating what we were talking about just a little bit ago, where you don't want all of capability X in one or two ships, because one thing that we know is when navies go to war, they lose ships, and you can't afford to have one ship totally stop you doing what you're doing. You need to have a little bit of defense in depth, not just at home, but with what you're pushing forward.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, and we also don't, you've covered this. I mean, they have the, you were looking at that the other day, the LPD accompanied by a destroyer now makes a littoral combat squadron. And what's not there? There is no LCS, you know, and I don't know what the LCS can do well or what it doesn't do well anymore, because I don't hear the good stuff that that ship is capable of. And we probably need to find out more about that. But, you know, they're making up a big chunk of the Navy now. There's like 13, 14 of them out of a 200 and some odd ship Navy. That's a big percentage of the fleet that we can't use, apparently, for the purposes that we really need to. We don't have enough escorts. You and I have discussed this repeatedly. You know, it's not enough that we need to escort the AOEs and the AOs and the logistics stream. But what about the amphibs? We may stick stuff on them, but they're still going to need escorts to get where they're going. And plus, we got the carrier, you know, needs. And I'm sure that somewhere there's a guy there with a big chart trying to make all this stuff match. But and I don't envy him his job, because I don't know how you can continue to try and stretch things as, you know, well, this DD can be in two places at once. Well, that has never happened in my lifetime and probably won't happen in anybody else's lifetime. But, you know, it seems to be what we do now.
Yeah, one of the scariest episodes we did, at least from my point of view, maybe you'll remember, but our guest name is slipping my mind right now. But we were talking about the military Sealift Command, and literally the plan is right now, when you get to the sea buoy, is haul ass. There's nobody. So we've gone back to pre-World War I. Good luck out there. We'll see you at the other end of the pond. That's just. A recipe. But I wanted to go back for a bit, because you said something that kind of piqued my mind. We're talking about, you know, we're not hearing anything about what is a big portion of our fleet, i.e. LCS. And the snarky part of me says, let's go, there is nothing, but that's not true, Matt Hipple. I'll give you a little credit there before you have a heart attack. A lot of that goes back to what we've talked about here. And I have a silver lining to the departure of Secretary Mattis. Regulars know I'm a Mattis guy, but I have always been willing to nod the head at the critique that when you need a Secretary of Defense, you need a Secretary of Defense, not a field marshal. So there's some opportunity with his departure to perhaps refocus. And part of that refocus, I think, will need to be a reappraisal of the defense approach to communicating with the public and the press. The Navy, I think, you know, before Mattis showed up, was already heading along this road. But the closing of the open door to communicating more with the public and the press about things military for specious reasons of security, which I don't buy, I think has really hurt us more than it's helped us. It's maybe prevented a couple people from embarrassing themselves or having to answer uncomfortable questions. But there's no place in history where a closed-minded organization has prospered. There was an interview, for those that were listening to National Public Radio today. Yes, I do occasionally listen to NPR. There was an interview they were replaying with the founder of Southwest Airlines, who passed away this week. And he talked about a letter that he put out to employees. I don't know whether he did it every year or there's just this one year. And he talked about his biggest concern wasn't the competition. His biggest concern was them, that we would get that Southwest Airlines would get too big, too cocky, too complacent, and that if we want to get big, that we need to think small. We need to see what the competition is doing that works and ask ourselves why we aren't doing it. And I just thought that was, it sounds like a fundamental, but I don't think it is, because, you know, the good fundamentals you repeat all the time. Just really, I'm going to find, I know there's a book out there somewhere about him. One of the things I'm going to do in 2019 is to read up on the founder of Southwest Airlines, because he just seemed to have, from a organizational leadership point of view, just some solid priorities on how he communicated to his people. And that's one of the things I'm hoping for with the departure of Mattis, is we could have the doors open for our friends in the press at least to get more access.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, there are a number of good reporters that we've talked to. We've talked to David Larder. We've talked to never my mind goes blank. We've talked to
We've had both Dave Larder, Phil Ewing, Chris Cavas.
Yeah.
Those three guys. I feel bad we haven't mentioned them earlier, but they've also been very kind to us over the course of the years, and they're just. If anybody in the audience is at some defense place and they hear that Larder, Cavas, or Ewing is in, go sit there and tap them on the shoulder. They're great guys when you get a chance to meet them in person. But they're great professionals.
Yeah, well, and you know, I think that a lot of the things that have, you know, let's just take the two collisions that we harp on repeatedly, you know. If the reporters had been allowed to do their jobs and able to get access to information, would it have been possible that they could have reported on those conditions that were, you know, setting up young officers and sailors for failure, because of the shortage of dollars, among other things, to get them to the kind of training they need and to we have enough ships to meet all the requirements without straining the ships that were there beyond their capability to keep their people trained and ready. And, you know, that leads me to one of the other topics I think we ought to discuss, which is one of the great things, not to dwell on the negative all the time, but one of the good things that happened during the last year was the Navy and the Defense Department finally getting a real budget, and no more of this at least temporarily, no more of this continuing resolution sort of thing, which there's no way to plan with that. And, you know, I think that would probably go down as my biggest story of 2018, and I hope it continues on to 2019 as being it's really vital for the security of this country that DOD is able to plan and have a budget they can plan with.
That's one of those unsexy but important items. Is actually being able to plan with a budget. Works for a family, should work for everybody else as well. And it's funny how things always prop up that you wouldn't expect to be a big thing in a year. And when I look at 2019, it's the same issues that I'm worried about in 19 are just a little bit different than 18, but not too much. Syria is not at the top of my list. I don't think that it's going to be just a long dance there. Nothing worth it really blowing up, which means it will be big. But something that I might write about this week is latest demographic information coming out of China. I think is both an opportunity but also a danger area, is China wants to do something with her position in the world. She's got a small window to do it, because demographically, especially, they've got about 12 years or so until they have a problem that even greater than Japan's going to have to deal with just a declining population, aging population. And we won't even bring in India into the discussion, because India doesn't have that same problem. They'll have a softer demographic landing. And closer to home, the situation in Venezuela, I don't know how much worse it can be. Luckily that we live in an era where people can leave. That's a pressure valve, but I don't know if that's good or bad in the long run. and the push to, and I can argue both sides of this, the push to find a way to decouple from Afghanistan, and all, nothing, something in between. I think that discussion in the course of 2019 could be very, 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 very contentious. But I hope it does place in 2019, because, again, we've got about three more quarters and we get caught up in the soup of the 2020 election, and good decisions usually don't take place in that environment.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we've been in Afghanistan 17 years. I think you and I have discussed in the past, I'm not sure what the original end, you know, if you begin with the end in mind, what was the original end that was in mind? You know, we're not going to ever turn that into a democratic republic, freedom of speech environment. And I'm not sure, you know, if the answer is we're just there to try and keep the Al-Qaeda's and the ISIS's of the world from doing another 9/11 on us, I think, you know, we would have, I think we discussed in the past, we could have argued for simply a very strong punitive expedition of some sort, and then get out and leave them to stew in their own mess. But I'm baffled by what we're up to. At least when we stayed in Europe as long as we did, we were trying to help people get back on their feet and eventually establish democratic forms of government in resistance to what the Russians were doing, the Soviet Union was doing with its various enterprises in Europe. And I, you know, now, as you've already noted, we've got China trying to figure out what it wants in its way to be in the world. And it can't, you know, as long as they can persist in the idea that they are the center of the earth and, the, you know, the Middle Kingdom, and everybody owes them obedience of some sort, then there's going to be a problem. And they need to get a little more realistic. And, you know, and it's not that they're not an ancient culture, but they are a new country in so many ways, and they really need to do some fast growing up.
Yeah, the Afghanistan thing, it's each passing month I get a little more blood pressured about it, in that I'm not sure who's going to do this, but you brought up a very good point about, you know, where did we start? And a lot of our problem in Afghanistan, because I did this for years when I was on active duty, is trying to get direction and guidance from the pole mill level, getting that via the means and capabilities that were provided to make it happen, to get to those objectives and those end states. But the problem you have is if you have goals / objectives and end states that are academic and unfeasible and have no sound foundation, you can never reach them. And there needs to be a huge amount of accountability on the national security intelligentsia, the blob, as some like to call it, but I think that's a pejorative. These are good people, smart people trying to figure out the world. But the last two decades plus, I think if you wanted to draw a real hard, fast line, the decision that was made to go into Somalia is as good of a signpost as any. There has been a strong desire for the world and other cultures to be what people want them to be, not what they actually are, and getting us involved in situations with them to meet and address those imaginary countries that don't exist. And we never get to the other end because you can't. And I think that is a lot of the problem that we have in Afghanistan. We've talked about it here a little bit, and I've written about the Bonn Agreement of 2001 and 2002 as being the original sin of it all. And there are some people in the national security arena, but going back to one of the things you talked about earlier in the show, is that bipartisan disunity. Nobody can blame anybody else for a political game on it because both sides are involved in it. And I don't know who's going to lead this Truth and Reconciliation Committee in the national security arena, but we need to have it because our best and our brightest have not made the best and the brightest decisions. And as a result, Americans have gone downrange to execute plans that are grounded in a universe that doesn't exist. And maybe that's why we are where we are, because we started off on a journey that is unachievable. It's what is it? The 21st century version of the Northwest Passage, where the theory was there, but at the end of the day, you just wound up frozen solid and dead. I don't know, but there has to be an accountability there because it's not working.
Well, if you have to, at some point, you have to recognize when you're, and I'm surprised that you have to be sophisticated enough to recognize that the way you believe is not the way everybody believes, and you're not going to solve the Shia Sunni schism in the Muslim community by providing them with democratic tools. That's not going to work. The mindset is completely different. I mean, solipsism, I guess, is the, we really believe that some people, and when your foreign policy is based on this belief that your way is the only way or the right way, and everybody thinks the way you do, you're going to have problems with that. Sometimes you just have to say they are the way they are. We're going to back off and let them solve their own problems. I don't want to go neo-isolationist, because I think there are times when we certainly need to be involved in the world, but there are times when we just need to say this is not our problem. We have done what we can, and we're out of here. And if they act up again, we'll come in and just, beat them back to the Stone Age again and wish them good luck another time. But we can't, you just can't keep throwing good money after bad, if you will, and certainly human American lives after these causes, which we're never going to resolve. It is in the nature of the people we're trying to help that they cannot be helped the way we're trying to help them.
Yeah, the people who got us the Bonn Agreement and the National Security Intelligentsia, they don't like the whole idea of punitive expeditions, but maybe we should try it a little more often, because we've tried their way, and it hasn't worked out. Again, you have to wonder, well, what if we hadn't? What if we had just gone into Afghanistan and taken the punitive expedition approach? Would the world be better or worse off now than it is? What if we'd ever went into Iraq in 2003? Would things have worked out better or worse than they are right now? We just don't know. But we do know where we are right now, and we do have agency for what we do in the future. And I think that is where we need to have a very clear-headed discussion before we go do stuff like this again. Is it worth it? Is it not worth it? Is it really our concern? I don't think the American public feels that it is, but because these have been low, relatively speaking, on an annual basis, that it's not top of mind for the American public, because it's not a full national effort, which is good in some ways, bad in another. But that's one thing that we'll be talking about this time next year, Lord willing, when we have our 10th anniversary show.
you're absolutely right, though. Sometime in the next year, it would be great if there were adult conversations among true leaders in our government about what are we doing and why are we doing it and is this the best path? You know, and sometimes, as you know, the best path is the least worst path. You know, so, and I don't mind discussions like that, but I would like it to be on an adult level. And the problem that, that you've addressed earlier is that we've got this nan-nanny boo-boo approach to, you know, what do you mean you're going to withdraw from Afghanistan? You can't abandon, you know, it's childish. It's gotten ludicrous. And we need to either elect people who are grown-ups or we need to the American people need to say, you know, enough of this nonsense. And we keep trying. I think some of these previous efforts have been trying to get folks to be a little more mature about their approaches, but that hasn't always succeeded. Anyway, yeah, I hope we're not discussing this on our 10th anniversary, but I suspect we will be.
We will. Well, we're at the top of the hour for our 9th anniversary show. And again, just like we started, I want to thank you. You're a great co-host. I think we hopefully have added more light than heat during the course of the year. And hey, we're going to boil up some guests here for the rest of the year. And I just, if people have made it this long into the podcast, that means they're regulars. And we occasionally get some ideas for guests from our readers that have turned out really well. So I'd invite our readers, our listeners. I would like to invite our listeners, if there are some guests out there, you said, you know what, I would really love to hear those guys on Midrats. Get in touch with Eagle One, get in touch with myself, either by email or Twitter. We're kind of skulking in both locations. We'd love to talk to them and bring them on during the course of the next year. And, hey, here's the 2019.
Yeah, happy New Year, and happy New Year to all the people who have taken the time to listen to us over the years and today. And we look forward to putting on some good shows over the course of this year. So, and I'm inspired now. I got some adults, and I got to go find some adults who can talk about things that we're up to in foreign policy in adult terms. And if maybe with some luck, we'll be able to do that.
Sounds good to me. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. And as always, thank you very much, and I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell.